And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
Spain's Catholic Church has excommunicated a group of 10 nuns after they refused to renounce their allegiance to a rebel former priest. The sisters, who live in a 15th century convent in Belorado on the St. James's Way pilgrimage route near Burgos, said last month they no longer recognize rule by the Vatican and claimed they were being persecuted over a real estate deal. The cloistered nuns, who belong to the Poor Clares order and were famed for the sweets they made, including a mojito-flavored confection, aligned themselves with a renegade priest considered a heretic by church authorities. The nuns, led by their mother superior, Sister Isabel de la Trinidad, said they no longer recognized the authority of Pope Francis or the Spanish church hierarchy and swore allegiance to Pablo de Rojas Sanchez Franco. Mr. Sanchez Franco is a controversial figure, himself excommunicated due to his support for sedevacantism, a movement that considers a papal chair is in fact vacant, as all popes since Pius XII, who died in 1958, are heretics. "It is very painful to hear the Mother Superior say the Pope is a usurper," said the Archbishop of Burgos, Mario Iceta, who on Saturday took the decision to excommunicate 10 of the 16 sisters from Belorado. Six nuns were spared as they were considered too vulnerable to be banished from the support of the Church. Archbishop Iceta excommunicated Mr. Sanchez Franco in 2019. He has since formed the Devout Union of the Apostle St. Paul, which he calls the True Church of Christ. Mr. Sanchez Franco is a follower of the ultra-conservative Opus Dei Catholic organization. He has described Spanish dictator Francisco Franco as our undefeated leader. The rebel nuns have been called to an ecclesiastical court accused of schism, but the deadline for their appearance expired last Friday. In a fax sent to the Archbishop's office, the nuns reaffirmed their unanimous and irrevocable decision to leave the official church and said any penalty imposed on them had no legitimacy. Sister Isabel de la Trinidad informed the church that the sisters had agreed to pay €1.2 million, £1 million, to buy and renovate a property for their future use. To raise funds, they wished to sell into private hands an abandoned Poor Clares convent. The church blocked the move, saying property was legally bound for religious use. The Ten Commandments are to be displayed in all classrooms in Louisiana after the controversial order was signed into law last Wednesday. The Republican-backed rule, which applies to all state schools and universities, was labeled blatantly unconstitutional by civil liberties groups who claim it breaches the principle of separating church and state. Critics have vowed to mount a legal challenge, and some believe the move may get a sympathetic hearing from the Supreme Court, which has become more conservative since Donald Trump and more inclined to rule on the side of religious rights in recent years. Jeff Landry, Louisiana's Republican governor who signed the measure into law, said, "I can't wait to be sued," last week, according to the Tennessean. By 2025, every Louisiana classroom will be required to display a poster or framed document measuring at least 11 by 14 inches with the commandments in a large, easily readable font. Mr. Landry argued that the Ten Commandments, which include injunctions against murdering, stealing, and adultery, provided valuable life lessons. "If you want to respect the rule of law, you've got to start from the original lawgiver, which was Moses," he said. In Stone v. Graham in 1980, the Supreme Court struck down a similar move in Kentucky, ruling that the Ten Commandments were plainly religious in nature. The instructions are not confined to secular matters, but also those such as worshipping God and observing the Sabbath, it noted. Lawrence Moore, a law professor at New Orleans Loyola University, who is also a Catholic priest, suggested Mr. Landry was trying to overturn the precedent set by the Stone case, but also had a much broader objective. "I think the goal is the assertion that we are a Christian nation," he told the Telegraph, adding that if Louisiana's law is upheld, it could reopen cases about prayer and scriptural readings in state schools that were settled decades ago. Christian conservative groups have recently attempted to push back on limits to public expressions of faith in the Supreme Court, which has proved more sympathetic to the issue than in the past. I think traditionally the Supreme Court would have decided against the posting of the Ten Commandments, Father Moore said, but I can't predict where the court is now. However, he suggested the measure might prove a bridge too far for the more centrist judges, just John Roberts, Amy Coney Barrett, and Brett Kavanaugh, who are much more attuned to precedent. Louisiana's push also reflects a broad skepticism from conservatives about left-wing ideologies allegedly being put forward in schools. Dodie Horton, a Louisiana state representative, said, "Given all the junk our children are exposed to in classrooms today, it is imperative that we put the Ten Commandments back in a prominent position." It may spur on other Republican-led states that have proposed the measure, including Texas, Utah, and Oklahoma, to follow suit. Critics claim the law breaches the Constitution's First Amendment that decrees the separation of church and state. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, it reads. Several organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, pledged to immediately challenge the legislation in the courts and accuse the state of trampling on religious rights. "The First Amendment promises that we will all get to decide for ourselves what religious beliefs, if any, to hold and to practice without pressure from the government," the group said in a joint statement. "Politicians have no business imposing their preferred religious doctrine on students and families in public schools. Louisiana's communities and public schools are religiously diverse, yet the measure would require school officials to promote specific religious beliefs to which people of many faiths and those of no faith do not to subscribe." They noted that the language of the commandments differs in various religious denominations, accusing lawmakers of pushing a state-sanctioned version of scripture. A tiny Colorado town has been plunged into a national debate after stopping a church from using its amphitheater for Sunday prayers. Town officials in Dillon blocked all non-town sponsored groups from using the space, including Dillon Community Church, which had held events there for 42 years after being inundated with rental requests. The decision has catapulted the 1,000-person town to the center of a debate about over worship in public facilities. Pressure groups on both sides are threatening lawsuits, with some demanding the church be given special dispensation to gather, while others slam the preferential access as Christian privilege. Town manager Nathan Johnson told the Denver Post, "There needs to be a separation of church and state. We cannot favor one denomination over another." The amphitheater was built in 1993 and renovated to become a top-of-the-range venue in 2018 with views over the water to the mountains beyond. Dillon Community Church have hosted their worship events there for decades, paying an annual $1,100 rental fee and drawing in over 300 people a week. Then, earlier this year, other groups including a synagogue and Native American tribes asked the council to use the space. Johnson told the Post, "Everybody's attracted to the lake, the natural beauty of the lake. The council can't accept everyone," he said, "and they had to place the other groups on hold. Now with the popularity of the venue, we have more and more people reaching out. Everybody wants to be down there." The issue, he said, is that an expectation has been set by allowing the church to use the space for their events. He added, "We haven't told anyone no, at least that I'm aware of. We want to have a clear and definitive direction from the town council on what is allowed and not allowed in this setting. If we are going to open up the amphitheater, we have to open it up for everybody." In an original meeting on the issue on June the 11th, the council voted 5-1 to grant the church special access to the site. But after public backlash, derided Christian privilege, and Dillon's Denver-based contract attorney Kathleen Kelly resigned over the decision, the council were forced to backtrack. Now they have temporarily blocked all third-party access, including the church, while they determine a legally defensible usage policy. Former council member Tim Westerberg slammed what he sees as political tactics from the council, saying, "They don't seem to care about what the Constitution says. It's just damn the torpedoes, full speed away, bulldoze ahead our agenda." Church members have rallied in response to the council decision, advocating for access for all religious groups. Church representative Wendy Meyer said, Dillon Community Church should be grandfathered into whatever contract. They've been here for over 40 years and attracts an incredible number of our visitors who come to the county every single summer and love coming to church. The council now has to tread carefully to avoid potential lawsuits on both sides. Madeline Ziegler, staff attorney for the Wisconsin-based Freedom from Religion Foundation, told the Post that if town officials have excluded any religious groups, members of that group could file a civil rights lawsuit. She said the town's historic preferential treatment has sent a signal to the town residents that their government prefers Christianity and that Christians will be treated better than other people in the town. That's not a message that the people's representatives should be allowed to send. On the other side, Lee Patterson from the Texas-based First Liberty Institute urged the council to allow the church access to avoid a lawsuit. The term Gutenberg Bible refers to each of the two-volume Bibles printed in Gutenberg's workshop around 1454. Before that, all existing Bibles were copied by hand. The process could take up to a year, said John McQuillan, associate curator at the Morgan Library. In contrast, it is believed that Gutenberg completed his work in about 6 months. Each Gutenberg Bible has nearly 1,300 pages and weighs around 60 pounds. It's written in Latin and printed in double columns with 42 lines per page. Most were printed on paper, a few others on animal skin. When a Bible came off the press, only the black letters were printed. Hand decorations and bindings were added later, depending on each buyer's taste and budget. Some ornamentations were added in Germany, others in France, Belgium or Spain. Therefore, each Gutenberg Bible is unique, McQuillan said. Gutenberg's invention produced a massive multiplication of complete copies of biblical texts. The first impact was among scholars and learned priests who had easier access than ever before, said Richard Rex, professor of Reformation history from the University of Cambridge. This massive multiplication even led to the wider adoption of the term Bible, Biblia, to describe the book, Rex said. Medieval authors and others do speak sometimes of the Bible, but more commonly of Scripture. Psychologically, Rex said, the appearance of the printed text, its regularity, precision, and uniformity contributed to a tendency to resolve theological arguments by reference to the biblical text alone. Later on, the printing of Bibles in vernacular languages, especially from Luther's Bible, early 1520s, and Tyndale's New Testament, mid-1520s onwards, affected the way the ordinary parishioners related to religion and the clergy. The limits of literacy still meant that access to the Bible was far from universal. Gradually, though, religious leaders stopped being its main interpreters. The phenomenon of lay people questioning or interpreting the biblical text became more common from the 1520s onwards, Rex said. Although the early Protestant reformers, such as Luther, emphasized that they did not seek to create an interpretive free-for-all, this was probably the predictable consequence of their appeal to Scripture alone. 3 times per year, a curator from the Morgan Library turns a page of the Gutenberg Bible on display. Its leaves not only tell a tale of Scripture, but of those who possessed it. A few years ago, by studying its handmade initials, McQuillan was the one to figure out the origin of its decoration, a German monastery that no longer exists. Similarly, in the 2000s, a Japanese researcher found little marks on the surface of the Old Testament's paper copy. Her findings revealed that those leaves were used by Gutenberg's successors for their own edition, printed in 1462. For as many times as the Gutenberg Bible have been looked at, it seems like every time a researcher comes in, something new can be discovered, McQuillan said. This book has existed for 500 years. Who are the people that have touched it? How can we talk about these personal histories in addition to the greater idea of what printing technology means on a European or global scale, he said. Among the thousands of Bibles that J.P. Morgan acquired, owners made various annotations, individual names, birth dates, details that reflect a personal story behind. A Bible is now a sort of book on the shelf, McQuillan said, but at one point it was a very personal object. In a museum setting, they become art and a little bit distance, but we try and break that distance down. And finally, Pastor Jamie cleaned the attic with his wife the other day. Now he can't get the cobwebs out of her hair.
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.